Let's jump into the reading of today's Boston Herald on the Talking Information Center for today. It is Wednesday, the 10th of June, 2026, and we say hello to Danny and Fred.
Since Ed isn't here today, I'll be working with Dan, and we're going to start off with the famous Howie Carr, who thinks that Scott Pelley needs to just fade away. Move over, Ted Baxter, Ron Burgundy. You're demoted to weekends. There's a new anchor airhead extraordinaire in town, and he's not even fictional. His name is Scott Pelley, although he prefers to call him Blood and Guts after his wartime heroes. As recounted in multiple recent slobbering interviews to which he portrays himself as the second coming of the famous World War II correspondent Ernie Pyle. Ernie Pyle, surely he meant to say Gomer Pyle. After 37 years as an unctuous fluffer for CBS News, Scott the Blood and Guts Pelley has just been fired from the bottom-rated network. He threw away the softest gig in the world, for which he was paid maybe $5 to $7 million a year, by mouthing off to his new bosses. CBS suits, reasoning that the same that was the same as that of the baseball executive Branch Rickey to his Hall of Famer slugger Ralph Kiner before refusing to give him a pay raise. We finished last year with you, Ralph. We can finish last without you. Blood and Guts is the ultimate legend in this town's in his own mind. Among the many facts that he apparently refuses to grasp is how much 60-minute ratings have collapsed over the last decade. In fact, their hackneyed brand of far-left agitprop would already be long gone if it wasn't propped up by its sports lead-ins, mostly the late NFL games on Sunday afternoon, but also golf and college hoops. But Scott Pelley has somehow convinced himself that in addition to being the second coming of Walter Cronkite, he's also a war hero. By his own account, he's been to heck and back. "I've been in combat for this country," he explained over the weekend, tears running down his pancake-made-up cheeks. "In Afghanistan, in Iraq, Kuwait, I've been shot at, spent nights in foxholes, filled up with water in the desert." Cue the waterworks, long pause, a gulp or two. The only thing Blood and Guts didn't do was bite his lower lip. "I'm not aware that the President of the United States has ever done any of this for his country." Trump got shot, you nitwit. He got shot in the head. The above quotes were from the second interview in which he portrayed himself as a cross between Audie Murphy and Sergeant York. He got roasted online the first time he went all stolen valor adjacent. But what does he care? He's Scott Pelley. Do you know who he is? Or should I say, because he finished now. All of the dinosaurs and dying regime-controlled media are too clueless to realize that they have no options left, none, until it's too late. Somebody, maybe their butlers, their chauffeurs, should have told them, just dummy up and grab the big money from the Democrat industrial complex for as long as you can. How are the post-network podcasting careers working out for you all? The fired news clowns, Chuck Todd, Don Lemon, Jim Acosta, Joy Reid, Terry Moran, John Howard, etc., etc. Scott Pelley is a guy who once anchored the CBS Evening News, which used to mean something in a very long time ago. Pelley claimed that he was removed from the cushy gig because of a hostile work environment. As someone who has worked in local TV news, I understand hostile work environments. And do you know when the TV news hostile work environments really get hostile? When your show ratings are lower than the whale excrement, which Pelley's were, and continue to be under a succession of ever more lackluster Ted Baxter's and Ron Burgundy's. Of course, Pelley claimed 60-minute ratings were up 9% last season. That's only because he had run a better-than-average NFL games as their lead-in. Have you ever heard of the dead cat bounce? That's what 60 Minutes ratings surge was. The fact remains that 30 years ago, before the Texas Air National Guard fiasco, among so many other fake news hoaxes, 60 Minutes had more than 20 million viewers a week. Now they have fewer than 10. Again, Scott, we finished last with you. Barry Weiss, the CBS executive who fired him, was charitable enough to send out pro forma eulogy praising the late Scott Pelley for his unforgettable stories, none of which anybody can remember. But as General MacArthur, or was it Blood and Guts Pelley, once said, old soldiers never die, they just fade away. And Blood and Guts always have his cherished memories. Perhaps he should do an oral history with Ken Burns before it's too late. All these heroic days at the front, slogging through muddy trenches and with fellow warriors, Brian Williams and Hillary Clinton, trading fire with surly makeup artists and bitchy hairstylists fleeing incoming. Boom mics and seeking refuge in the near blue porta potty, ready to be occupied by Graham Plattner and his trusty bottle of lotion. From Kelly's heroes to Pelley's zeros. Now the 60-minute shock is tick, tick, ticking for Blood and Guts. His 15 minutes of fame are almost up. Now stop co-hosting Jim Acosta's podcast or maybe Camelot High in Cambridge, sharing an office come January with a fellow washed-up war hero, Tim Walz. You've been fired, Scott, but don't look at it as a pink slip. Think of it as your DD-214 from the Ministry of Truth.
And from today's Boston Herald, the picture on the front page, Quigley Quagmire, and the story continuing onto page 3 by the author Colleen Cronin, Quigley Intervestigation. The investigation was what it was. No full detailed crash reconstruction ever performed in the fatal state police cruiser crash. The Mass State Police did not perform a full detailed crash reconstruction after one of their own sergeants allegedly drunkenly hit a wheelchair van in 2023, according to a Suffolk County prosecutor. I know a full detailed reconstructionist exercise was not done, Special Prosecutor Ian Palombaum said during a pretrial hearing for MSP Sergeant Scott Quigley's motor vehicle case. The Quigley is accused of driving with a blood alcohol level over the legal limit in December 2023 when he veered into oncoming traffic and hit a wheelchair van. Quigley and a passenger in the van, Special Olympian Angelo Schettino, were both seriously injured. Schettino died in the hospital a month later, and Quigley spent about 8 months on injury pay. Details about Quigley's blood alcohol level taken at the Leahy Clinic after the crash were brought to light during a wrongful death suit filed by Schettino's family. Palombaum, who was appointed as a special prosecutor after the Middlesex District Attorney's Office referred the case to Suffolk earlier this year, told the judge, "We weren't involved at the time of the initial investigation. The investigation was what it was," he said. At the time of the crash, Quigley received a marked lanes violation in the Middlesex DA's office, where he was embedded as a homicide investigator, said they weren't aware of his alleged blood alcohol content until this past January. The sergeant was suspended without pay from the MSP around the same time that the accusations emerged publicly. Quigley's attorney, Christina Pujols Ronan, said that there was no accident reconstruction performed, even though it was MSP policy to perform them for crashes that cause serious bodily injuries. Ronan said the discovery motion for any reconstruction materials would be argued at Quigley's next hearing on August 19th. The MSP declined, through a spokesperson, to comment on the lack of crash reconstruction out of respect for several current investigations, including an internal affairs probe and independent external review from a firm hired by the Massachusetts State Police, as well as the ongoing criminal investigation by the Suffolk County DA's office. According to dash camera footage first published by the Herald, the investigating officer, Lieutenant Jennifer Penton, was urged not to go to the hospital to interview Quigley on the night of the crash by a higher-up officer in the Massachusetts State Police. "I wasn't here. There's no witnesses," Penton says on the tape. "I'll see what the other driver says." She tells the other officer that the van Quigley hit was on their own side of the road, and it appears that Scott had his phone out. She also tells the other officer they're looking out for him. Maybe they know that it was his fault, and that they're like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, let's just wait on this." Penton was recently suspended with pay for a separate incident. She and three other troopers were charged with manslaughter in connection to the 2024 death of trooper trainee Enrique Delgado Garcia, who died after being knocked out during a boxing match at the State Police Academy, and she has pleaded not guilty. Fred?
The Supreme Judicial Court upholds a no bail ruling. Three charged in alleged Lowell murder to stay behind bars. The Supreme Judicial Court upheld a decision from a single justice barring bail for three alleged murderers whose Lowell trial has been paused because of state police scandal. Earlier this year, brothers Billy Beloim and Chana Fan were in the middle of their second trial for a 2020 murder of Tyrone Fett, when the Middlesex District Attorney's Office disclosed that its lead investigator in the case, State Police Sergeant Scott Quigley, was allegedly involved in a fatal drunken cruiser crash in 23. The disclosure continues that the trial continued the trial while several investigations, including a criminal investigation by Suffolk County District Attorney's Office, was unfolded. During the continuance, counsel for the brothers filed motion for bail reconsideration with Middlesex Superior Court Judge Christopher Barry Smith. They decided to set bail at $25,000 for each defendant, but the SJC stayed the bail decision after an appeal from Middlesex. Then a single justice overturned Barry Smith's order, saying that he relied too heavily on the amount of time the fans had remained incarcerated following their arrest through the first trial, and now as their trial is paused. Monday's full SJC decision affirmed that finding, stating that the bail judge has discretion, but it's not unlimited. The justices wrote that the strength of the Commonwealth's case against the Fan brothers alleged efforts to conceal their crimes and their criminal history weighs against allowing them to be released. In light of these considerations, we agree with the single justice that the trial judge abused his discretion by assigning too much weight to the length of the defendant's detention and what he deemed to be the equities of the case. The decision stated that the disclosure of the alleged misconduct surrounding Quigley's 2023 fatal accident and the resulting state police investigation Since the disclosure and the fan's trial continuance, the independent review of the Middlesex DA's handling of the case found that no attorneys were aware of the alleged allegations against Quigley until immediately prior telling the defense. The grand jury has also indicted Quigley, who pleaded not guilty to motor vehicle homicide. Billy Chan's lawyer said that the defendant's counsel had already filed another motion for Judge Barry Smith to reconsider last Friday's writing to the Herald. We're not giving up yet on the bail.
And this from page 2 of today's Boston Herald from Lynn by the author Rick Sobey. Sentencing in deadly crash. Family says remarkable young woman was killed by a wrong-way robber. A man who robbed a 7-Eleven before killing a remarkable young woman in a wrong-way crash while fleeing the police has been sentenced to prison. Salem man William Legger, 40, is facing decades behind bars in connection to the death of Ashley Forward, 19, back in June of 2021. 5 years to the day, Legger committed a robbery at 7-Eleven on Lincoln Avenue in Saugus and then fled from a cop. Legger drove a stolen vehicle south in the northbound lanes of Route 107 and collided with Forward's vehicle. Forward, of Lynn, who had just finished her first year as a nursing student at Emmanuel College, was killed in the crash. She was visiting her grandmother when the devastating crash happened. Legger entered guilty pleas to charges of manslaughter, unarmed robbery, and receiving a stolen vehicle. He was sentenced to 18 to 20 years in state prison for the manslaughter charge, to be followed by 6 to 8 years in state prison for the unarmed robbery charge, and that will be followed by 5 years of probation. Before the sentencing, Forward's younger sister Jillian and her mother, Michelle Luongo, spoke about the impact of Legger's actions and of Forward. She was an athletic graduate of Kipp Academy in Lynn Collegiate High School, who was on her way to becoming a nurse. Also, Forward had volunteered with my brother's table and with the Boys and Girls Club of Lynn. Ashley was a remarkable young woman with a bright future ahead of her, her mother said. She was kind, compassionate, and always willing to help others no matter what. Nursing was not just a career choice for her. It reflected who she was. She wanted to care for people, to comfort them, and to heal them, her mother added. Her life mattered deeply, not just to her family, to her friends, or the community where she gave so much of her time, but also to the people that she would have helped along the way, her mother said. Fred?
And from the category crackdown, the Fed's Trinitarios decimated in latest bust. Charges connected to alleged murders, beatings, and drug dealings, and more. Authorities charged over 24 members of the Lawrence, Haverhill, and Boston chapters of the Trinitarios gang, detailing allegations of brutal murders, violent crime, drug trafficking, firearm offenses, and more. This morning, federal RICO conspiracy charges were unsealed against 26 members of the Dominican-based Trinitarios gang, a transnational criminal organization operating in Massachusetts, who are alleged to be responsible for 5 murders and 19 attempted murders, announced U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Leah Foley. Over the past decade, the Trinitarios have allegedly participated in at least 15 murders, 30 attempted murders, armed robbery, assault, kidnapping, firearm trafficking, witness tampering, and retaliation and extortion. The unsealed federal indictment and the 465-page affidavit to lay out the charges against the 26 members, including the leader of the Lawrence chapter of the Trinitarios, Yerdali Yorel, and other senior members. Authorities stated in a press conference announcing the sweeping bust on Tuesday morning. Charges include connections to 5 murders, 19 attempted murders, armed home invasion in Massachusetts and Maine, drug trafficking, and other horrific acts of violence, law enforcement said. The bust marks the culmination of an over 2-year investigation and the 4th takedown of the Trinitarios gang members in Massachusetts since 2019. In February 2025, law enforcement last announced charges against 22 members of the Trinitarios Lynn chapter, including the alleged state supreme of Massachusetts and the second in command. Law enforcement heads from the U.S. Attorney's Office, FBI, Homeland Security Investigations, Massachusetts State Police, and Essex County District Attorney's Office detailed a sweeping complex investigation that has now led to the arrest of 56 leaders, members, and associates of the Trinitarios, allegedly involved in 15 murders over the past 10 years. The investigation involved the recruitment of well-placed sources within the gang, surveillance-controlled drug and firearm purchases, and rigorous intelligence gathering over the course of the years, officials said. As a result, more than 24 dangerous individuals are now off the street, and at least 30 illegal firearms have been seized, and kilos of deadly drugs will no longer reach our neighborhoods. FBI Boston Special Agent in Charge Ted Dox said of the latest indictment Tuesday. Dox said authorities seized enough fentanyl over the course of this investigation to kill a staggering 1 million people, which is a little bit more than the entire population of Essex County. The investigations aimed not just to solve the homicides and shootings and target leadership and stymie the flow of drugs and firearms through the gang, but to remove the core group of the Trinitarios, who recruit largely enough high schools in high schools in Lawrence and Lynn by urging young people to commit shootings or violent acts to earn initiation, the affidavit states. Foley said yesterday authorities believe they have successfully decimated the Trinitarios, holding on to the communities in Lawrence and Lynn. The massive affidavit released Tuesday shares grisly details of the investigation, recordings, and recountings of incidents from the forced overdose to punish beatings to home invasion and more. As you read through the filings, you'll see that the boldness and hubris, which is quite frankly astounding, said Foley. It appears to charge the defendants believe they are immune from prosecution. They were wrong. On social media, Foley said, Trinitario members posted brazenly about gang affiliations, acts of violence, structure, and positions within the gang, finding a location to carry out beatings and shootings and more. Posted photos, including in the affidavit, showing members flashing the gang signs, carrying guns, including a large AR platform rifle, flashing the kilograms, bricks, and suspended fentanyl and more. Recordings of Lawrence Trinitario leaders or Premiere Yerali Yorel, also known as O.G. Lowe, including the affidavit capturing him urging members, "We will run this city," stating, "I choose violence," and at once expressing hesitation about promoting a serial killer at the same time as calling the members a star who could influence people to do things that normal person wouldn't do themselves. In other recordings, the members of who Yoro called serial killer and eventually promoted to a position of disciplina, Yahir Davila, allegedly discussed killing a government operator and said that if he was caught, he'd be executing people inside there for real. These and other recorded conversations are not only evidence of alleged crimes charged to the superseding indictment, said Foley. They also promote detailed insight into the one that of the most violent gangs in Massachusetts. Although the investigation was learned about the gang's structure, their motivation, and their arrogance, they spoke openly and moved freely about without fear of consequence until today. In one incident, the cooperating witness, terrifying in a shooting, was allegedly ambushed by the gang's members and made to choose between overdosing on fentanyl and being shot, an incident corroborated by witnesses, including a 9-year-old girl. Another incident documented a recording by a cooperating witness shows that the Trinitario's disciplined ritual requiring that punishing members to hold up two guns, gang size, and corresponding Dios Patria Libertad, while being hit with a paddle as a primera euro counts the strikes. If the sign falls, the beating alleged starts over again, the affidavit states. Euro was arrested Tuesday morning at his home in Lawrence, where the agents stated they also found a large bag containing high-capacity firearms, large amounts of ammunition, and almost 2 kilograms of cocaine and fentanyl. Today's message is clear. We have the resources, we have the capabilities, and we have the patience, said Jeffrey Grimming, acting special agent in charge for the Homeland Security investigations in New England. To those who wish to inflict violence and harm on our communities, we are coming for you.
In this story from today's Boston Herald, Campaign Trail by the State House News Service. Short Sleeve says, defund lawmakers, says that he would slash the funding for lawmakers if they don't comply with the audit. Angered by the legislature's tactics to curtail the scope of the voter-backed audit law, Republican Brian Short Sleeve said Monday that if he were governor, he would veto the budget appropriations for the House and the Senate until they fully comply with Auditor Diana DeSoglio's probe. If Short Sleeve wins his bid for the corner office, he pledged to take away the money that covers legislative operations, salaries, and leadership stipends. His campaign for the Republican nomination for governor pegged that the dollar amount at about $110 million. Here's my view, he said. If you're refusing to comply with the law and the expressed will of the people, taxpayers shouldn't be forced to keep writing you a blank check, Short Sleeve said at the press conference outside of the State House. In more than 20 years building companies in the private sector, I've learned a simple lesson. If you don't do the job you're assigned to do, you don't get paid. And if you refuse oversight, there are consequences, he said. According to the state's final fiscal 2026 annual budget, the legislative appropriations totaled $91.3 million, including $49.8 million for the House, $30.7 million for the Senate, and $10.7 million for joint appropriations. At a sparsely attended event, a white banner behind Short Sleeve said veto in capital red letters. Short Sleeve's proposed maneuver would likely be thwarted by the legislature, which can overturn a gubernatorial veto with a two-thirds vote in both branches. But asked about that possibility, Short Sleeve said, it starts with leadership. And he accused Governor Maura Healey of not returning a phone call or an email to DiSoglio in more than a year and a half. As governor, I will take action, Shortsleeve said. Maura Healey has taken no action, he said. Fred?
And from the state, Governor Mum on audit bills. Healey wouldn't say if she was ready to sign. Governor Maura Healey played hot potato with a question on bills that would limit the scope of the legislative audit, refusing to say whether she supports them or not. The legislation just passed the House and Senate, and it would limit the scope of the legislative audit ban that the courts from adjudicating any future disputes regarding public records access, and would allow the legislature to object to cooperating with the audit as it sees fit, among other measures. The ongoing legal drama surrounding the audit, approved by 72% of the Massachusetts voters in 2024, has become quite the political hot potato for Healey, who has publicly expressed her support for the audit, but has not gone beyond that which any substantial beyond that with any substantial substantive actions. I've been clear about the audit. I support the audit. I think it should happen. I voted for the audit, and I'm really clear about it, Healey said Tuesday. When asked by the Herald if she supports either of the bills before ending her media scrum with the reporters. What about the House and the Senate bills specifically, said the Herald, pressing Healey on the issue as she walked away without delivering an answer. Last week, following the House passage of its new transparency bill, State Auditor Diane DiSoglio blasted Speaker Ron Mariano, Quincy, and other House members, also calling on Healey to veto the bill. They're painting this as some sort of a transparency measure. They're conducting a victory lap right now for themselves, patting themselves on the back for helping to ensure transparency and accountability, and using all the buzzwords, DiSoglio said in a video posted on X slamming the legislation. This empowering the courts, further empowering themselves. I don't recognize our state legislature right now, and I don't recognize what they're doing right now as being anything other than even close to what the Democratic government looks like. They get together behind closed doors with people calling themselves transparency advocates who are friends of the establishment. They get them to say a couple of nice things about what's happening, probably having traded something for themselves in it, she said, called an act promoting transparency and public access in state government. It would only allow an audit on the limited records outlined by the Supreme Judicial Court in its recent order, which includes the adoption of the official budget by both chambers' expenditures, joint legislative operations, and monetary settlement agreements, all dating back to 2021. It would also exempt the legislature from the public records law, which it already is under current state law, but would enforce the governor's office, to comply with it. Currently, Massachusetts is the only state in the U.S. where the governor's legislature and judiciary are all exempt from the public records law. Additionally, the House bill would bar the courts from adjudicating any future disputes regarding access to public records instead of establishing a dispute resolution process between the auditor's office and the legislator to avoid endless and costly litigation. The House proposal came a week after the Senate voted 33-6 in favor of a resolution that allows the audit to be carried out, but with extensive limitations, something Senator Ryan Fatman, Republican Worcester and Hampton, describes as a retreat dressed up as a magnanimous gesture with an audit escape hatch. The escape hatch Fatman referred to can be found in line 61 of the resolution and would allow the Senate to not cooperate with the audit, stating that the Senate reserves all the rights to object to any such audit, to present or future, and on any grounds.
And this from today's Boston Herald opinion page by the author Stephen Moore, who is a former Trump senior economic advisor, entitled Signs of Growth, Trump's Critics Dead Wrong on the Economy. Last week's blockbuster jobs report, with more than 265,000 jobs added when including upward employment revisions, was very welcome news to almost all Americans. The exception would be the economists of the left, who throughout Donald Trump's now 5.5 years in the White House keep getting the economy dead wrong. Just a few months ago, a gaggle of economists on the left, led by Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman, stated warning stagflation, a witch's brew of high inflation and high unemployment at the same time. And he wrote that any statement that things aren't as bad as they were in 1970s should come with the caveat, so far. The Liberal Center for American Progress told us that we were already in the danger zone, claiming that the Trump administrative agenda has generated stagflation, slower growth, and faster inflation. These are the same false claims that were made during Trump's first term, when some critics warned his policies would cause a second Great Depression. Instead, incomes for American families soared in real terms by more than $6,000. And so far this term, medium household income is up $3,000. The nation's unemployment rate of 4.7% is one of the lowest in the industrialized world, and it indicates that for most American workers who want jobs, they are out there. Meanwhile, there is a construction boom going on in America, driven by new spending on plants, factory equipment, road building, and data center construction. Manufacturing is roaring back. The Institute for Supply Management's Manufacturing Index, which tracks factory activity across America, has registered the sector's fourth straight month of expansion, the best numbers in 4 years. Then there is the bull market in the stock market. Despite some recent sell-offs, this rally has sent all the major indexes, the S&P 500, the Dow, and the NASDAQ, soaring to record or near record highs. The aforementioned Krugman warned last week, before the strong job numbers came out, that Congress needs to repeal the Trump economic agenda. We need, he said, a demagification of the American economy. Which policies exactly? Well, it's true that some of the tariff policies have bumped up prices, but three mega Trump policies, all of which Krugman and the Democrats in Congress opposed, paved the way for this economic comeback. First, the Trump tax cuts have stimulated business investment and hirings. They've also saved the average family more than $2,000 in a lower tax bite. Second, deregulation has saved American businesses nearly $1 trillion by cutting costs from thorny and expensive rules. Those cost savings will help drive down prices. And third, the pro-America energy production policies have turned the USA into the world's largest oil and gas superpower. Gas prices would be at least $1 a gallon higher without the domestic drilling boom, the rapid rise in investment, spending by businesses, and the America-led AI and tech boom, are likely to drive productivity up and prices down. And if history is any judge, it's wise to bet on the Trump economy and against his critics, who have a perfect record of being wrong. Fred?
Yeah, and to smoking. NFG is bad business and bad policy. You're heading to a golf course with a friend, and you stop at a convenience store to pick up some Red Bull and a couple of Black and Mild cigars. You don't smoke cigarettes, but you enjoy lighting up after 18 holes. You show your ID, you're over 21, so the sale is legal. But your friend, who's over 21, also an occasional cigar smoker, is denied because of the year he was born. This scenario illustrates the problem at the core of the so-called nicotine-free generation bylaws, NFG, currently being debated by boards of health across Massachusetts. These policies are arbitrary, burdensome, and unlikely to produce meaningful public health benefits. Under NFG rules, adults who work full-time jobs, raise families, and are subject to being drafted into the service and influence public policy notionally with their vote are barred from purchasing nicotine products solely on account of the year they were born. NFG creates a two-tiered system of adulthood, enforced not by law enforcement officers, but by retailers, often small independent ones, and at the point of sale. Proponents argue that NFG will accelerate the decline in the rate of smoking and eventually eliminate nicotine use altogether. But smoking rates were falling long before NFG entered the discussion. According to the Centers for Disease Control, in 2024, the smoking rate among American middle and high school students was a tiny 1.4%, an all-time low driven by cessation programs, 21 and over laws, and decades of education. There's no evidence that layering the generational ban on top of those successful policies will improve outcomes materially. There is evidence, however, that NFG shifts enforcement onto business. Brookline adopted the nation's first NFG bylaw in 2024. The model has since spread to a handful of Bay State communities, but even supporters acknowledge that the practical challenges. The store clerks must calculate eligibility not by age but by birth date, often at busy moments in front of impatient customers. Meantime, the same products are available online and in adjacent towns, so NFG doesn't actually stop anyone from buying what they want. Some local officials have raised concerns about fairness. In Barnstable, the Board of Health voted 4-1 against NFG. Board members Donald Guadagnoli summed up the issue succinctly. If people from 250 years ago could see this, they'd be shocked. Yarmouth's experience illustrates how controversial NFG can become at the local level. Yarmouth's Board of Health began discussing the policy earlier this spring, only for the selective board to intervene after widespread public opposition. It still hasn't been resolved. The opponents' concern are well-founded. NFG doesn't prevent access to nicotine, though online sellers that don't verify age. It doesn't stop adults consumers from traveling to neighborhood towns that don't have the restriction. It does, however, penalize the one group of stakeholders who consistently check IDs, law-abiding retailers. Convenience stores already manage ID checks, monitor fuel sales, oversee lottery transactions, and engage in countless customer interactions. NFG adds another layer of complexity, compelling retail clerks to enforce an opaque prohibition on befuddled prospective customers who are adults by law but minors in effect in the eyes of the Commerce Board of Health. In the U.S., Massachusetts stands alone in pursuing this approach. That alone should prompt a pause. The COVID-19 pandemic taught us that public health policy is effective only when it's evidence-based, actionable, and widely accepted. NFG falls short on all of these counts. NFG is a illiberal distraction. Supreme Judicial Court upheld Brookline's policy as legal, but legality isn't the same as soundness. There are better ways to eliminate smoking bans than imposing impractical mandates that create a permanent class of disenfranchised adults. Massachusetts should stick with the tried and true cessation programs, education, and enforcement. As towns consider these regulations, they should ask themselves whether NFG meaningfully advances public health or instead creates needless confusion, inconsistency, and friction.
And from today's Boston Herald business page by reporter Tim Dunn, bars will now be open until 3 a.m. Safety on tap with 3 a.m. closing hour. A boost to businesses, but drunks beware. As America celebrates its 250th birthday this summer, and as the FIFA, FIFA World Cup Soccer, makes its way to Massachusetts, Bay Staters will have some extra time at the bar before having to pack it in. Governor Maura Healey has signed legislation allowing Massachusetts bars to serve alcohol until 3 a.m. in an effort to help businesses capitalize on the influx of tourists expected this summer for the World Cup soccer matches and several events marking America's birthday milestone. But when asked Tuesday about potential safety hazards that could result from the temporary law, like an increase in drunken driving accidents, and particularly by illegal immigrants driving accidents, Healey avoided the issue and did not answer the question. I'm glad that the World Cup, we have this opportunity to try this out at 3 a.m. I mean, there's been a lot of demand for it. We've got games going on all over and all over and around the clock. And I think this will be a nice opportunity. Bars and restaurants aren't forced to stay open, but if they want to stay open and serve alcohol until 3 a.m., I think there'll be a lot of demand, Healey answered. We've got a lot of people coming in, she continued. We've got a lot of people ready to take advantage of this. So I think it's a good thing. And obviously, public safety is top of my mind, top priority with this whole World Cup experience. And I think people have been working really hard to do that, she said. Less than 2 weeks ago, an intoxicated illegal immigrant drove in the wrong direction in the northbound lane of the Peabody section of Route 1 before crashing in to a responding state trooper's cruiser. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, took Lucas Gustavo Brechek de Almeida de Benedetto, 41, into custody shortly after his arraignment at Peabody District Court. The trooper was taken to the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. That incident came just 2 weeks after another wrong-way driver killed 30-year-old Massachusetts State Police Trooper Kevin Traynor on that same highway just a few miles north. Called an act authorizing municipalities to opt in to a temporary pilot to extend the hours of their liquor licenses and to allow for public consumption in designated districts in summer 2026, it also temporarily allows alcohol to to be consumed in locally designated areas through July 31st. Massachusetts welcomed over 52 million tourists in 2024 who spent over $24 billion statewide while supporting more than 155,000 jobs and generating more than $2 billion in state and local tax revenue, according to the governor's office. Fred?
Under Washington, Social Security shortfall looms. Funding gap approaching sooner than expected. Washington Social Security Retirement Trust Fund is projected to face a funding shortfall in 2032, a year earlier than last year's projections, according to the annual report released Tuesday, while Medicare's Hospital Insurance Trust Fund will be unable to pay full will be unable to pay full benefits in 2033, which is unchanged from last year's estimate. Rising health care costs and government spending have contributed to a projected depletion date that is far less than 10 years from now. There's less than 10 years from now. The looming challenge for the program is a partial funding gap, not a collapse. Even after trust fund depletion, the system will continue issuing benefits, albeit at reduced amounts. Last year, Medicare's Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, Medicare's Hospital Insurance Trust Fund go broke date was pushed to 2033 from 2036 the year before. That according to the reports from the program trustees. Meanwhile, Social Security's combined trust funds, which cover old age and disability recipients, will be unable to pay full benefits beginning in 2034, unchanged from the 2025 report. After that, incoming revenues will cover about 83% of the scheduled benefits. Social Security Commissioner Frank Bisignano and President Donald Trump's administration is committed to protecting and strengthening Social Security and eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse, ensuring the program's integrity. The new funding shortfall is mainly the result of lower projected birth rates, reduced immigration, and reduced trust fund revenue due to the costs of a Republican massive tax and spending bill that Trump signed into law last summer, according to the report. Nancy Altman, president of the Social Security Works Advocacy Group, said that the latest report takes Donald Trump's second-term policies into account, a tax bill that largely benefited the wealthy and economic wrecking tariffs, a needless war with Iran, and hostility to immigrants. All of these have reduced the amount of money going to Social Security, weakening the system's finances. AARP's CEO Maya Chia Minter-Jordan said in a statement that the latest numbers should be a wake-up call. Congress needs to act. Americans have worked hard and paid into Social Security their entire lives, and they deserve to count on it when they retire, she said. No family should see any cuts to what they've earned in Social Security. About 70.1 million people are enrolled in Medicare, the federal government's health insurance that covers those 65 and older, as well as people with severe disabilities and illnesses. Social Security benefits were last reformed roughly 40 years ago, when the federal government raised the eligibility date for the program from 65 to 67. The eligibility date of 65 has never changed for Medicare.
Also from today's Boston Herald, remembering a giant, statue unveiled for late business magnate philanthropist Jack Connors. Elected officials, business leaders, family, and friends turned out in front of Boston's John Hancock Tower Tuesday morning to unveil a statue honoring revered and celebrated philanthropist and business magnate Jack Connors, Jr. Connors, who passed away at the age of 82 in 2024, was well known for his charitable and often unsung contributions to Boston's hospitals, schools, youth programs, and more. He even became the guardian angel of Camp Harborview after the late mayor Tom Menino turned to him for help, allowing inner-city kids to become seaside campers along Long Island. This is the perfect spot in the perfect park of our city to have this memorial that will forever help us remember the good that was put into the world from Jack and all the many conversations that he had that turned into big ideas, challenges, and possible things that the city and others would then have to scramble to make sure we could bring to life, said Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. This is a statue that, to me, is something that means to evoke a good thing that Jack was. If you come to visit it on days to come, if you have an opportunity to sit on this bench, I hope that you will be remembered and always of the values, the things that Jack really stood for, added Governor Maura Healey. Connors is survived by his wife Eileen, a daughter Suzanne Joyce of Westwood, three sons, John III and Tim, both of Westwood, and Kevin of Dedham, and his sister, Margaret Hanks of Dedham, and 13 grandchildren who had the honors of unveiling his statue to the public for the first time. Fred?
The cape to the World Cup fans, be shark smart. It is rare for a great white to bite a human, but it can happen. The cape this summer could see some brand new visitors, prompting officials to give them a heads up about the apex predators close to shore. With the World Cup coming to Foxborough, the Cape Cod National Seashore is getting the word about white sharks to soccer enthusiasts who might spend some time along the Cape. Great white sharks every summer and full migrate north in fall. Excuse me, every summer and fall migrate north to the Cape as they hunt for seals close to the shoreline. That has led some dangerous shark-human interactions over the years. As the World Cup tourists arrive, the National Seashore is educating them about how to stay safe at the beaches. Cape Cod National Seashore welcomes our extra visitors this week, who are the area of the World Cup matches, or in the area for the World Cup matches. The National Seashore posted on Tuesday. Cape Cod's waters are part of the natural and wild marine ecosystem with a rich diversity of sea life. This includes sharks, which have existed for more than 400 million years. Seals are the major prey species for the great white sharks. The seashore added the seal population has recently rebounded after the animals were driven to near extinction by boundaries and hunting. More seals mean more great white sharks to eat them. White sharks have been seen feeding on the seals close to shore. Spotter planes flying along the Outer Cape have spotted great white sharks near swimming beaches, and that, I guess, is all we have time for today.
Thanks for listening.